is the Day Zero update for June 3rd, 2018. I'm Filippo Genolfo.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
This is a very light show today, I would say. Mostly because nobody else decided to show up.
No, there's been a lot going on.
E3's coming up.
Fault anybody.
Yeah.
E3's coming up. We're all sort of trying to get our stuff together before that happens.
This week is kind of the inhale.
Yeah.
Before everything hits the fan.
Yeah, come Saturday, basically, we're going to be in full-bore E3 mode, and yeah.
Hopefully we get to break something awesome again.
We've had this scheduled for a little while. Honestly, when I reached out to Barry, I didn't think he was going to be willing to do this, but I'm super glad that he is. Our guest today is none other than, would you say legendary? Nah, well, I just did. Legendary composer Barry Leitch.
Thank you very much. Hi, guys. How y'all doing?
Hello.
I'm good.
I'm doing great.
Tired, but well.
Barry, you have had a long and very illustrious career. Still going, I would imagine. Horizon Chase isn't going to be the last thing you do.
Hopefully not.
And now we're going to need Horizon Chase 2 pretty soon.
Cool.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. I wanted to start a little bit regarding the early days of your career. As somebody who's composing music, obviously you're also somebody who loves music. So I'm kind of wondering, like, when you were in high school, what were you listening to and what inspired you to get going?
Well, I think with music, it started before high school. My grandfather loved music. When he was in World War II, and part of the morale thing for the troops is they put on these big shows for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said one of the most emotional things he ever saw was this concert they gave where they played a piece by Handel called Zadok the Priest. And he absolutely loved that. When you hear this piece, it's a piece of music for a coronation. And it's absolutely massive. It's huge. Choirs and orchestra. But that's what ignited his passion in music as a young man. And so when I was young, he had this little record player, and he'd play music for me all the time on it. I mean, some of it was kind of cool. But some of it, there was one Sparky and his musical piano or something. He used to play that all the time for me. I hated that. But there was another guy who used to play. It was a British guy called Wally Whiten, who was a skiffle band. He also did children's songs. And he'd just sing these little, I don't know, half a pound of tuppenny rice and Pop Goes the Weasel, these kind of things. And I loved those. And that got me interested in music. And as I grew up older, I liked to play around on a keyboard. We had a keyboard at home. But I couldn't play properly or anything. And then when computers came around, that was about the age of 11 or 12. Computers were amazing. I mean, this is like, oh my God, these are so good. It's so much better than, playing outside on your bike, riding around in circles for hours. You could actually sit in front of a computer and make something change on the TV or try and make sound on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so from the early computers, the ZX81, the Sinclair Spectrum, BBC, I was always messing around with sound on these computers. And you have to think back then too, the only way to create a piece of music was to play an instrument well. And the fact that you could program a computer to play a piece of music, it was incredible. So that just attracted me to it, like a fly to a light, or moth to a light.
Right.
And it was about 1984. I was about 14 years old. Rob Hubbard released a demo on the Commodore 64 showcasing his music. It was four or five pieces of music. And it sounded almost like real music. I mean, it was all synthesized computer sounds, beeps and boops, if you like.
Oh, nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounded much closer to real music, much more closer to real music than anything else had up until that point. And so from then on, I mean, he was creating music for video games. I decided, you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to make music for video games. That's just the coolest thing on the planet. And of course, my parents said, no, don't be stupid.
Naturally.
But I'm stubborn, so I won out in the end.
Yeah, I think people forget that sort of like back in the 80s and 90s, well, mostly the 80s in particular, gaming culture between what was happening over here in the U.S. and what was happening over in Europe is actually pretty different, mostly because the sort of key, like, main consoles and, you know, setups people were using were completely different.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was totally different. I mean, I think Americans very much just like that console style of gaming where you just plugged in a game and played it.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, everybody wanted, holy shit, I can make a game from this.
Everybody was like, was on the Spectrum or, you know, it was, like you said, the Commodore, you know, basically home computers.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. The whole industry of video games in Britain grew up from children making them and selling them to other children.
Yeah.
And so you saw this demo from, Dr. Rob Hubbard at this point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that got you into it. So I'm guessing your the first platform that you programmed on was the C64.
That was the first one I got that I published on.
Okay.
Managed to get sold. I mean, I'd been dicking around with BBC Model Bs and Spectrums and for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, the Commodore 64, me and a buddy would make, we used to make tons of demos, pieces of music and artwork. And we'd share them at the time with, because there was a whole sharing culture. People would go to a computer club every week and swap copies of discs and stuff because there was no internet. So, yeah, we used to do that. And
That had to be a great experience, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was tons of fun. I mean, there was a constant one-upmanship. I mean, if Rob Hubbard found a new sound to play on the Commodore 64 through his music driver, or somebody found a way to put a scrolling message in the border of the screen where you weren't supposed to be able to write to, that would be sent out, you know, it would make its way through all the computer clubs across Britain, and then somebody else would see it and think, oh, I've got to find out how to do that and try and make it better. Instead of just having text in the border, let's have text with color in the border.
Yeah.
Things like that. And
yeah.
So, constant improvement.
Yeah. So that kind of gets me to, the differences in the various chips that you were working with at the time. Because I think in terms of the 8-bit era, there really wasn't much that could touch the SID.
No, the SID kicked ass. It was an awesome piece of gear.
Yeah. Then you had the Amstrad, and that was using
AY, same as the Spectrum Plus 3 and the Atari ST. And yeah, that was a shitty sound chip. I hated that.
So, yeah, what makes a good sound chip, in your opinion?
It was the ability to create your own sounds. I mean, there was the Commodore 64, and then the Amiga was the next big groundbreaking one, because you had your own samples. And there wasn't much after that until the Roland MT-32, which was like 1990 or 1989, I think, in America.
Yeah.
But the MT-32 was awesome. I mean, you could create all these sounds in it. It was a really cool piece of gear.
Yeah, it was. A very expensive piece of gear. I know I lost it after one.
Yeah. People used to pay $1,000 just to have music and speech in the games because they'd have to buy two sound cards. They'd have to buy the Roland for the music and the Sound Blaster for the speech.
Yeah.
You try telling that to people these days. We want you to pay $1,000 and away can you go.
Oh, yeah. You damn kids today with your high-speed internet and having sound built into your machines. Back in my day...
Yeah, get off my lawn.
Exactly. I'll pull that trigger.
So, yeah, I know that Rob Hubbard was probably responsible for the meltdown of many SID chips. yeah, and I actually do mean that literally.
No, I don't doubt you.
There was, at least here in the U.S., when we had the C-64s, one of the problems was some of them weren't built particularly well and were overdriving the SID a little bit too much.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Commodore had problems with quality control back then. Not sure how it was in the European factories where those were made, but here in the U.S. it was pretty shitty.
Yes, it was.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Nope.
So,
know about that.
Yeah. And then again, those systems were so easy to service that most people just fixed them themselves. That was one of the great things about those particular computers back in the day. They were all fully documented. You could look at the board, you could see what things did, and get in there and tweak to your heart's content. So
pretty much.
Yeah. I understand that you're actually currently looking at remixing Spellbound.
Yeah, I got asked to do that for the Rob Hubbard Kickstarter thing. I've forgotten the official title. Chris Abbott will be mad at me for nothing. but yeah, they're doing this whole thing with the end result is a concert of Rob's work, as well as other people's work, I think, in Britain next year. But there's also several CDs. They've got Rob doing orchestral arrangements of his music, which is fantastic, because he's pretty much retired now.
Yeah.
But they've managed to lure him out with the promise of an orchestra and a couple of beers. That's great.
You just place little steins of beer like in a line leading to the concert hall.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But part of that, one of the CDs is they're having all the guys who were composers from the Commodore 64 to each remix one of Rob's tunes. So they obviously everybody wants to do their favorite tune, so I picked Spellbound because on the Commodore 64 that piece of music is. I have to say it's the definitive piece of Commodore 64 music. I mean, it's a great tune, and technologically it's just amazing with all the ring modulation and arpeggios. It's a fantastic piece.
Yeah.
And I'd started remixing it like 12 years ago. And I never finished it. I got sidetracked. So I fired that up the other day and I thought, you know what? I can do a lot better than this now, so I'd scrapped everything that I'd done, and I'm starting from scratch again.
Yeah. Well, I'm very much looking forward to seeing what you come up with now. I mean,
me too. I'm excited.
Yeah. So, that's in progress, but don't expect to see something, too soon for there. But I'm guessing you do have a deadline at some point.
I've got 3 months to do it, so I need to get it done.
Yeah. So, all right. So we'll get on to the transition from the various generations of computers and consoles. Because we started with, basically on the 8-bits, where we ended up with beeps and boops and the SID, which was a three-voice programmable synthesizer, which, let's face it, it did far more than it was ever intended to. And then we ended up at the consoles with you had the Atari ST, the Amiga, getting into the 16-bit generation, the SNES, the Mega Drive. And at that point, I think people actually started to get that, you could do really, really excellent, really realistic-sounding music on these platforms. So I'm wondering what that shift was like for you.
It was a pain in the ass. What's a better word? You have to remember that each of these computers required its own music driver and the music arranged specifically for that hardware. So people say, let's take Prophecy the Viking Child. Well, that's one game that has 20-odd tunes in it, and it's going on the Commodore 64, the Spectrum, the Amstrad, the Atari, the ST, the Amiga, a PC, PC Adlib, PC MT-32. you're looking at it's 8 to 10 versions for every single title.
Yeah.
And that's how, I mean, these days you work on, like, Horizon Chase on the PC. Well, it's the same music that goes on the PlayStation. It's the same data. Nothing needs to be done to it.
Yeah.
But in the old days, you had to program it all for each of those separate machines, which was a lot of work.
Yeah. And I understand that you also have a hatred for the Mega Drive.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, we had, at the time, there was the PC Adlib card, which was also FM Synthesis.
Yeah.
And that was pretty terrible, because we didn't have a specific music driver for it at the time. And it was very tricky to get good sound and instruments on it. And the Mega Drive had the same kind of hardware. And we had a terrible music driver. I think I only did one game for the Mega Driver. It was Gadget Twins. I'm not sure if it was even released. I think it was. I think I've seen some videos on YouTube.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah. But, yeah, the music driver we had was terrible, so I couldn't get good results. They all sounded just as shitty as the Adlib card. But when I was at Ocean, I remembered somebody coming in one day that said, hey, I've made this really cool music driver for the Mega Drive. You guys want to use it? So we're like, well, let's hear what it can do. And we listened to it, and it had sampled drums. It had really tight timing. You could do all this fancy stuff with the instruments. We're like, yeah, that sounds great. How much do you want to use it? And they're like, well, it's like $5,000 or £5,000 every time you use it. And so, no, we're not having that. You can just
Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't Gems, was it?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Gems rings a bell. That sounds like the standard. That could have been the one we were using.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Gems was problematic in some instances, but, you know, you could get some decent results out of it if you really, you know, put your time into it. Unfortunately, a lot of people couldn't.
Yeah, that was difficult.
Such tight deadlines.
You have to think, too. I mean, we were... I'm living in Britain where everybody's got an Amiga or an ST. Nobody really had the SNES or the Genesis. So we were kind of like, eh, who cares about those versions? It was very kind of throwaway. It was a bad attitude to have. I mean, we had no idea how big they were in the world or how many copies would sell.
Yeah.
To us, it was just another format to get through so we could get on to the next project.
Yeah. So that leads me to the 32-bit era, which I think is when things started to get a little bit more standardized. Well, with the N64 being the exception.
So, like, the Amiga console, was that 32-bit?
Technically, yeah, it could be considered a 32-bit console, but right, well, I'm still using...
That's the CD era kicking in,
yeah.
Where suddenly we went from having to create from creating basically music data that the computer replicated into or converted into sound, was that we went to becoming recording artists, recording music that would play back on these devices through just the way we recorded it. There was no chance of it changing, you know. We were recording WAV files instead of data files.
Yeah.
And so for us, that was like, holy shit, this is it, you know, we've made it. We're now doing the same thing that everybody else in history making music has, you know. We've come to that point in just a few short years.
Yeah.
And at Ocean, we had like 5 or 6 synthesizers shared between 3 of us. So on any given day, there was always a fight over who got what synthesizer.
Yeah. You know, what was it like working at Ocean? I've heard mixed.
It was. I thought it was awesome. For me, it was like a holy shit, this is it. It's not going to get any better than this moment. Because I grew up reading about Ocean, how they worked under the church in the catacombs on Central Street. And when I joined them, it was the very last week at the catacombs. They were just about to move offices, and they moved into these shiny new offices in Castlefield. And to me, I just thought it was the best thing ever. It was cool as hell. We had enough chairs for everybody. We didn't have enough synthesizers, but, you know, we were getting paid every week, which was a novelty too.
Yeah.
Until that point, we weren't always getting paid.
Yeah.
We used to have to, at Imagitech, we'd always have to fight with an artist for a chair every day because it was like one chair short.
That's, yeah, I can see how that would get kind of irritating on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah.
On a regular basis, you'd have to wonder at what point that had to be somebody trying to screw with people.
Yeah.
It was just because there was no money. I mean, we had no hardware. We had the basic computer stuff. We didn't have fancy speakers or synthesizers. I mean, we had nothing. And we were getting paid, oh my God, it was like £4,000 a year. Which is pretty much the same as unemployment is, or was.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit specific here as far as Top Gear goes, because, well, we're going to be talking about Horizon Chasing a little bit, and, you know, Top Gear is very much the origins of that.
Yeah.
You were at Gremlin when that was made by Gremlin, obviously.
Oh, I was at Imagitech.
You were at Imagitech at that point? Okay.
Yeah, but one of the bosses from Imagitech had gone to work at Gremlin. And Gremlin and Imagitech had a pretty close relationship because they were just an hour up the road from each other.
Right.
I think Imagitech had done a couple of conversions for them, Butcher Hill and, I don't know, some other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, Ben Dalgleish had worked at Gremlin. Jesus. So many names. I'm getting old. So Ben had got canned or left Gremlin. And so they were stuck without an audio guy. So we had, because we had the music drivers that could play on across all the different formats, Gremlin were like, hey, can we get Barry to do some music for this game and stuff? So it was very much like a pimp and prostitute relationship. So Imagitech would just pimp me out to whoever was hiring.
Okay.
And so for Top Gear, I'd never worked on a Super Nintendo game before, I don't think. And so I got sent down to Gremlin one week, and we took a look at the source code for the music driver and stuff, and we realized we didn't have any samples for it. So it's like, I can't make any music. And I'm like, well, go back to Imagitech. So I went back to Imagitech, and Gremlin got a hold of Chemco and said, hey, can we have some instrument samples for the Super Nintendo? They said, sure. They sent a couple of floppy disks over of, to be honest, they were pretty shitty sounds. Just, you know, there was like a couple of kick drums, a couple of snare drums. But that was it. I mean, there was two floppy disks of sounds. So they said, hey, tell Barry to come back down. So Barry gets dispatched back down to Gremlin and arrived on a Monday morning and had to get the music finished by Friday. So I had 5 days to get it all done in a system that I'd never really used before. So I got to dick around with these new sounds and trying different things out with the music driver. So when I started out, I decided, you know what, I'm going to make a little arpeggio just up and down the music scales to test. And so I got that playing, and then I found this echo command that it had. And up until this point, no other system had a DSP effect like that in it. So to me, this was awesome that you could have an echo effect played from the synthesizer. It was all made in real time. So the first thing I did was put a big, huge echo on the arpeggio. And I compiled it, and then the programmer leans over, and he says, yeah, you see that number there? That's how much free memory you've got left. You've used the entire memory for the whole thing. So I had to dial the echo back, and I kept dialing it back and asking him, hey, can I have this much? He's like, no. Can I have this much? No. So it gets down to the point where it's just a really short echo. And so that's how the Top Gear Vegas piece has that arpeggio with the little echo on it. Because that was all I was allowed.
Yeah. It's like, I've never actually heard anybody who's, you know, been that specific about the kind of limitations that the consoles had back then. Because it really was kind of a collaboration between the programmers and the sound guy at that point.
Yep.
It was like, it was a very much a give and take, mostly give.
Well, totally. The manual was all in Japanese. So I had no idea. So you look through the source code, the example source code, and then you just start changing it to see what things did. And then you work, okay, so that changed this note. So that's how the notes work. How do we change the note lengths? That's how it went.
From there.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't mean to be over specific with the technical details.
No, this is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how the Top Gear soundtrack kind of got its start. But did you have any idea of the vision of it? Like what you kind of wanted it to sound like before even heard these samples? Or you just kind of winged it?
Just winged it?
Yeah.
It's Monday, you know, you've got 5 days ahead of you. Let's get the music done and then I can go home.
Yeah. Go home and have some beer, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you did a remarkably good job considering what you were working with.
I don't know. I listen to it now, and it makes me cringe in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and yet there's elements in there of greatness. Yeah. We'll say that.
I think I got lucky.
Just for time.
Yeah.
The Vegas piece is the only one that uses all 8 channels. The other ones only used 4. So you could tell I was getting lazy. Because what happened was I spent that first day or so learning how the music driver worked, and then I expanded on that arpeggio and the chord progression and made that first tune. And so by then it was probably Tuesday, Wednesday afternoon, and I'm thinking, okay, well, we've got one tune done, and we've got, 2 days left, 3 days left. We need to do something quicker, so let's hurry it up with the other tunes. Let's just get them done, get them in the game, and we'll call it good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It worked out. And then, but you didn't work on the sequels, I'd imagine, though.
No, Top Gear 2, I think, was Patrick Fallon, because it wasn't long after that I went to Ocean from Imagitech.
Yeah.
And Gremlin hired. They decided, fuck it, we'll just get our own audio guy now.
Yeah. And from there, the next Top Gear that you would work on would be Top Gear Rally on the 64.
Yeah, that was kind of weird, you know, sitting in Seattle it wasn't 10 years later. It was probably about 8 years later. You know, I'd moved all the way around the world and then get the chance to work on the sequel to a game I'd worked on an ocean away, you know. It's kind of weird. But that was fun to do.
Yeah, very different style, that one.
I don't know. That was a rough time. I was going through a divorce at the time, and I think it was affecting the music. I don't think the music for Top Gear Rally was very good. It's kind of morose in places.
Now that I think about it, yeah. And yet, on that... Go ahead.
I was just saying it's a little depressing, but I mean, I wasn't trying to make the music as fast-paced. The game wasn't super fast-paced.
No.
It didn't have that feeling of speed that you had on Top Gear, so the music was a little slower, and I was trying out different things. I got steered into making a grandiose title tune with the piano and some stuff, you know. I was trying to make it a little bit more epic.
Yeah.
It was probably more likely that I saw another driving game that had a piano thing in the title tune, decided to copy it.
Yeah. And the working on the N64 was, I've heard, a little bit of an interesting experience in that it was not exactly straightforward.
It wasn't that bad. I mean, for Top Gear Rally, we had, I think the programmer made a XM player. XM is a format derivative from the old Amiga modules, so right. I could use Fast Tracker 2 to compose the music in. But later on, when I did Gauntlet Legends and Gauntlet Dark Legacy, Rush 2, Rush 24/9, Cal Speed, those ones we used a MIDI playback routine. I think it was Factor 5 made the music driver for the N64. They became the official music driver supplier. And it was a really, really powerful system. I mean, you could do amazing compression on the samples and the music data. Gauntlet Legends has something crazy, like 2.5 hours of music, and it only takes up like a megabyte of cartridge space.
Wow.
With all the instruments. And,
that's efficiency.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. You know, you spend a lot of time, and that includes all the sound effects too, so there was a lot. Yeah. It was a lot of work in that.
Yeah, yeah. Also a game that I enjoyed immensely back in the day. I was always been a fan of the Gauntlet game, so.
Yeah, it was a fun game. I used to have the arcade machine. I had that for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So now, of course, we get more to present day, and now we're seeing kind of a resurgence as far as games that are trying to be retro, but also blending modern elements into them. Yeah, and your, well, Horizon Chase is a great example of that. Axiom Verge, that I'm a huge fan of, is another. What do you think of this movement?
I think it's pretty damn cool. I mean, I think somewhere along the line, games just became a lot of hard work, especially the driving games. I mean, if you play some of the high-end driving games, you've got to spend like 2 hours tuning your car, trying to get the angles on the ailerons and the back right, and the adjusting your brakes and your gear ratios. Fuck, that sounds like, if I wanted to do that, I'd go work in a garage. You know? I just want to pick up a game and play it for 20 minutes, then get on with my life.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see the resurgence of that. I think mobile gaming really helps that too. I see the kids playing all these little, silly little games that just kill time for a few minutes. Same with Candy Crush, you know?
Yeah. Apart from the questionable business practices of some of those. The concepts behind them are pretty... Yeah. So, yeah. It's also very possible to take this kind of retro aesthetic and make it look like complete garbage. So... Mm. Yeah, Horizon Chase is not an example of that.
Yeah, there was one that came up. I was asked to do some music for a game, and it was a very retro-looking game. And I tried playing it, and it played like shit. And it played like shit, and it looked like shit. And it was like, dude, I can't work on this. You're not going to sell 20 copies of this. It's not going to make any money for anybody.
Yeah. I guess that game never came out.
I think it did, but I can't remember the name.
Yeah. Aquarius got a hold of you on Facebook, from what I understand. What did they show you initially when they were asking to hire you?
They showed me a picture of a blocky car on the road. And, I mean, looking at it now, it's like, oh, my God, that looks terrible. But at the time, I thought, you know what? That looks kind of cool. That could work. Mm. And they were just super passionate and stuff, so they got me all excited about working on it.
Yeah.
And that can make all the difference.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And, of course, that was also... Had you been out of game composing for that,
time? No, I mean, I'd been... doing little bits and pieces over the years. I mean, I do a lot of dialogue editing for games, as well as I did some voice acting for, what was it called? Pirates of Voodoo Island or something.
Mm.
I'd done a couple of little indie pieces. I mean, nothing major. I hadn't, obviously, since I moved into toys, working at Fisher-Price, and then going freelance, toys had very much been my focus, and I hadn't really bothered much with games. So it was really nice when they came along, and I mean, we had no idea it was going to be successful or even good. I mean, it just seemed like a fun thing to do at the time. I think, I mean, I came really close to not doing it just because, you know, it's another video game, and it didn't seem like it was... Traditionally, these days, video games don't sell an awful lot. It's very difficult to make money at video games,
mm-hmm.
which means I'm not going to get much money out of it. So I came very close to not doing Horizon Chase at all, but it was just their passion. And I think in the end, I said, you know what? Fuck it. Why not? Let's do this. It'll be fun. And turned out it was. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. When you get a crew together that's, you know, really into what they're doing and... it also helps that they were incredibly talented.
Yeah.
Definitely see that.
Oh, definitely. And Brazilians, I mean, you have to remember, I mean, these guys played Top Gear for many years. And they played it with their brothers, their cousins, their sisters. They have a really, really strong emotional attachment to the music and to the game. And so when they, when I get to meet them and stuff, when I went down there, I mean, these people grip your hand firmly, stare you straight in the eye and tell you, oh, God, I really love the music for that game. And it really reminds them of that time they spent with their, with that person they played the game with. They have a really strong emotional attachment to it, and it's really touching.
Yeah, I know for myself, like, I definitely remember the times I spent, back in my bedroom with friends overnight.
Nice.
Basically just,
It can be a little intimidating, though, when you've got this 6'5" Brazilian monster who wants to give you a big hug.
Yeah.
Please don't kill me.
Yeah, but, man. Yeah, I guess that's one of the things that really, that I really enjoy about Horizon Chase is I feel on a very deep level that same kind of passion coming back.
Yes. You know, on the day it released, I invited all my buddies over. I was like, hey, guys, come on over, bring your kids. We'll sit down, play some video games, have some food, have a laugh. And they all came over, and everybody would just swap out who was playing. You know, we had it in four-player mode. And everybody had a great time. Just it bridges that generation gap. Mm-hmm. You know, parents can play with the kids can play with the parents. Because a lot of the time, you know, kids want to play dumb games with you and stuff that you don't care about. But this is one that's fun that everybody can sit and play, and it's really good.
Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah, so what about the soundtrack in particular? Any one element that you kind of wish you had basically done a little bit better?
I don't know.
Do you have any?
Some of the guitar. I mean, I use synthetic guitar. But it's difficult to find a guitarist that can play the stuff that I'd written. Bleeding Fingers, that race too. So Nino Mega Driver is the... plays guitar in Brazil. He's got a heavy metal band. They play covers of music. And he was the one that originally contacted me in the early 2000s. And he said, hey, I can play Top Gear on the guitar. I said, fuck off. No, you can't. Nobody can play that. That's stupid. He said, no, I can. Here's a video. And he sent me a video of him playing the guitar. And I'm like, holy shit, this guy can play the fucking tunes. So when I was writing Bleeding Fingers, I'm sitting there writing, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to make a guitar solo that even Nino can't play. And so I wrote this crazy guitar solo. And when I was finished, I couldn't wait to send it to him. And I sent it to him, and I says, all right, let's see you play that, motherfucker. And that he fucking played it. Wow. He played it live down in Brazil. When I was down there, he did a concert, and he played it live in front of everybody. It was so impressive.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah,
that is fantastic.
Yeah, man, we've heard Mega Driver's like work before, and it's like this guy is just—he, I don't know how he has that much dexterity in his fingers. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, he's fast.
Yeah. Yeah,
but that's the thing. I don't know. What do you think I could have done better? What didn't you like? That's a good question. Nobody tells me what they didn't like in Horizon Chase.
What I didn't like, the only thing I really didn't like is I felt like some of the melodies kind of reused themselves a little too often.
You think? See, I tried very hard to avoid writing pop songs or just songs that, you know, have a verse, chorus, because right. I know that you're going to be stuck hearing that tune 20, 30, 50 times.
Yeah.
So I tried to avoid using hooks like that that would get too catchy. I tried to spread it out so there was like maybe one little hook at the beginning of the tune and maybe one later. I tried to avoid repetition too much.
Yeah, it wasn't so much that as the fact that the order that the songs appear in the game tend not to follow the order that you have them on the
soundtrack. Yeah, well, see, that's completely out of my control. Now, when they first released the game, Initially, I had only done, I'd only written five race tunes, and then they came back and they said, look, we need a few more race tunes, three or four. And so I'd written the extra ones. So, and then that all happened very quickly. They sent me the game, and I was playing it, and I'm playing through the game, and I'm like, guys, I don't hear any of the fucking new tunes. Did you not put them in? I mean, what happened? And they're like, they're in there. Just wait, you'll find them. And so you wait and you wait and you wait, and all the way up till Greece, which is like the, I don't know, the fifth or sixth cup, it's only playing those first five tunes. But then when you get to Greece and the Acropolis level in particular, where all of a sudden it's thunder and lightning, and it first it plays that first of the new tracks, the heavy metal, the, I think it's Balls to the Wall is what I called it. It was, you know, and it's got the thunder and lightning going, and it just, it works so perfectly in the game. It really was a nice attention to detail. I think if they'd put it earlier in the game, it wouldn't have worked so well. But when it finally appears there, you're like, holy shit, that's kind of cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I just found that in playing a lot of those races earlier on, I just tended to hear those same tracks, not over and over again.
They use the title as one of the in-game tunes as well.
Yeah, which I don't think worked quite well.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, and then that's a variation on the Top Gear theme, which they also used in there. And I agree. You could have probably used another couple of tunes.
Yeah. But, you know, for the most part, I think it turned out well. And, well, I bought the soundtrack from you on CD, so I'm looking forward to getting my copy of that.
Awesome.
So
that's, thank you very much for your support.
No, it's no problem. Okay, what else?
It is really great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hey, are you other guys going to buy a CD as well?
As soon as things settle down a bit on my end, definitely.
Yeah,
that's good to
no
hear.
No comment.
He just moved, so yeah. Here's that. What was I going to say?
I'm literally sitting right next to a giant wall of boxes right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that reminds me. Yeah, we were talking about Horizon Chase being derived from Top Gear in some instances, which in itself was also kind of derived from your work on Lotus and Lotus 2.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were working on a remix of Lotus 2 at one point. Did that ever materialize?
Yeah. There was one on the Immortal series.
Hmm.
But I'm actually supposed to do another remix of it soon. I've probably said too much already.
Yeah, we've got a little
project exclusive.
We've got a minor game industry event coming up next week. We might be hearing something about.
Yeah.
No. It's not a game thing. It's a retro audio thing, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Project. So before we get to the future, I kind of want to wrap up with what would you say is your most favorite chip to program for?
I always liked the MT32, simply because we invested the time in creating our own music driver and editor for it, so we could create these incredible sounds that were, I like to think they were better than what everybody else was doing at the time. When I went to work at Origin Systems in Texas, I mean, they were, to me, they were the leaders in MT32 music, and I like to think that I'd given them some serious competition when it came to that stuff, because Nino Vugrinec, he did all the music for Strike Commander, which was a great flying game. And in Britain, I had written all the music for TFX. So we had these two competing titles. And I used to give Nino a lot of shit. We'd argue about who had the best electric guitar on the MT32.
Yeah, the MT32, I really wish I could have afforded one back then, and couldn't then. I still can't now, because now they're really expensive.
Yeah, I know. I sold one a couple of years ago. Shit, I wish I'd kept it and sold it now.
Yeah. Yeah, it just goes to show, retro computer hardware doesn't ever get obsolete. It just gets vintage.
Apparently.
Yeah. So I guess we'll wrap up with our last little question here, which is, where do you see game music going in the future? I mean, right now we're kind of at a point where game music seems to be mirroring what's happening with movies. You've got the big epic scores, and it seems like we've lost something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think with those big epic scores, and with games being such an interactive medium, it makes sense to have the music manipulate in real time with the action that's on the screen. The trouble is that musically is that you could be halfway through, you know, your verse or your chorus and or your melody hook when the action changes. So then you have to morph from your exciting part into your very calm part, and your melody just kind of gets lost. And I think musically, it doesn't always make sense to do that. I mean, atmospherically, it does continue the atmosphere in the game, but musically, to a listener, you know, the piece changed at the wrong place.
Yeah, it's kind of jarring.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of frustrating for people. I mean, if you think of films like Last of the Mohicans, where they had that epic theme at the end. It was a big piece when the girl goes and jumps off the cliff. I mean, it works so beautifully. But in a game, there's no way to predict that that same linearity. You know, you're either being attacked or you're being calm. You know, there's too much change, and there's no way to compose that well enough, I don't think.
Yeah.
To cover all the possibilities of mood changes and to keep it musically as catchy or engaging as you'd like.
Yeah, so you're not a big fan of the interactive scores, I take it?
Not overly. I kind of like the... I mean, they sound beautiful. I mean, you listen to them and you think, holy cow, that sounds like a full orchestra. That's great. But, I mean, would you listen to it in your car? No.
Probably not. Yeah.
But then something comes along with some pop tunes. I mean, they're happy little tunes that you want to listen to. You're like, yeah, stick that in the car. It sounds great.
Yeah.
Speaking of happy little tunes, I do have one little story to tell you. So right. Horizon Chase, game completion music.
Right.
Game completion tunes in general. Nobody ever gets to hear them. Nobody plays the game all the way to the end usually. You know, people get bored. They give up. The game's too hard. And so... when they asked me to do the game completion tune, I started writing it, and then I thought, you know what? I know that the people playing this game are going to put in the time to finish the world tour. They're going to have spent 30, 40 hours playing this game just to get to this point. And most people are going to do it, I think. I don't think people are going to give up too easily on it. So I thought... I mean, they were only asking for like a minute of music, just a little happy tune.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if I do that and it plays, if I'd played for 40 hours and it played a little minute of music, I'd be kind of bummed out. You know, I decided in the end I was going to make this huge, epic 5-minute long tune that it goes through the gamut of emotions that you have when you finish a game like that, because you're ecstatic that you finally finished it. But then also, you're a little sad because you finished the game. What are you going to do now? Tomorrow, you're going to come back and you finished the game. So there's a nice little sad bit in it, and it kind of, you know, brings the mood down. And then I thought, well, there's no way in hell I'm going to finish on a sad note. I'm going to finish on a great big finale, do a big happy bit, and I had a lot of fun writing that one. Did something special. 5 minutes of music that wasn't asked for.
For an ending, that's exceptional.
Yeah. It was fun.
It's also wasn't the only bit of interesting music in Horizon Chase, and you probably know what I'm referring to.
Which one?
The Secret Proposal.
One, yeah. That was fun. Yeah, that was pretty.
Yeah. Given what, but obviously it worked. And for those who don't know, Barry hid a wedding proposal to his wife inside of Horizon Chase. And this was Actually, wasn't it discovered a little bit beforehand?
It was, actually. Some guy, I've got him on Twitter, it was this kid, he'd left his iPad with his kid, and his kid's sitting playing it, and all of a sudden he hears this different music playing, and he's like, what the hell have you done? And he goes and finds it, and takes a picture of it, and tweets it to Aquarius, and they're like, oh my god, don't tell anyone, this is it. But we used to put Easter eggs in games, especially in driving games. They'd put them on the billboards at the side of the road. You know, you'd see stupid messages in them. I think California Speed has an exceptionally bad Easter egg in it on the back of one of the billboards. I'm not going to tell you what it, you can go look for it. But it's bad programmer humor. But so I'd said to the Aquarius, I'm like, look, I'm thinking of proposing to my girlfriend. Is there any way you guys could sneak a wee Easter egg in? Just something on a billboard or something that flies past really fast. And they said, oh, hell, we can do better than that. And they set up this big Easter egg where if you drew a love heart on the screen, it would bring it up. And then the coolest thing was they sent a film crew to Scotland for her to film her seeing it for the first time. And we had to tell her a story about how they were making a documentary about the game and the wives of the developers and stuff. And she told herself for it. It was great. The video is just superb.
I just saw the California Speed one.
Wow.
The California Speed one. Sometimes God makes puppies and little girls disappear, and sometimes, just sometimes, I do.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah.
Programmers.
Yeah. So, the Easter egg obviously worked, because you have been happily married for, 3 years now.
2 years. 3.
Wow. Well.
Yeah. Congratulations. And
thank you very much.
I wish you many, many years of happiness to come.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. All right. So I guess, unless there's any final thoughts from any of you guys or anything, Barry, you want to plug, we'll kind of wrap up here.
Yeah, you can go to my website, barryleach.com, and buy a copy of the Horizon Chase soundtrack on CD, signed by the composer himself. It'll be priceless once I'm dead.
All right. I'd like to remind you folks that if you have not subscribed to the podcast, you should probably consider doing so. You can do so on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast aggregator. You can also check us out at smashpad.com, where we post our written reviews and other editorial content. So with that, I am Filippo D'Alfo.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
And I'm Brandon Perkins.
And we'll see you next week for E3.